President Trump tweeted a message in advance of his re-election campaign launch this week, saying that millions of people who are in the country illegally would be deported starting next week. Here's the president before his campaign rally Tuesday.
And they're going to start next week. And when people come into our country and they come in illegally, they have to go out.
Officials from the Department of Homeland Security raised questions about that number, telling the New York Times that millions of people could not be deported immediately. However, there have been signals from Immigration and Customs Enforcement staff in recent weeks that raids targeting thousands of migrants in their communities were on the way.
Elise Cohen is an immigration expert and associate professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. Elise, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Well, the president's tweet and statement signaled deportation of millions starting next week. It looks like that process will be much more scaled back, according to what we're hearing from immigration officials. What do we know?
Yeah, that was a tweet sent earlier in the week and got a lot of attention because of the number, because of the language of sort of mass deportation. But you're right, it's sort of been walked back a little. So, for example, yesterday, the acting ICE director, Mark Morgan, focused on some undocumented families who already have deportation orders. And that number that he's using now is around 2,000. So we're sort of moving from millions to thousands. And another thing to keep in mind, I guess, with Trump's tweet of deporting millions is that he didn't really specify a time window. So potentially that leaves the door open that this could be over the next, you know, year and a half or so, that he would aim for constant increases in deportations.
You mentioned that ICE, the priority looks like a specific category of people who have already received deportation orders. Who would that be? What part of the process would they have gone through?
Yeah, that's a really good point to focus on. So the acting ICE director is talking about undocumented families, and this is a change from the previous administration. Under the Obama administration, the priority for deportations was particularly those that had committed criminal offenses. That priority structure is gone now with the Trump administration, and Mark Morgan is kind of doubling down on that, which previous directors had said as well, that it's not just those with a criminal record or violent offenses. It's really anyone that's here, and that includes family units. So this roughly 2,000 or so is part of a number of undocumented families that already had final deportation issues ordered, which means an immigration judge already ruled on their case. A lot of controversy surrounds that because their adjudication was expedited. Some of them claimed they didn't even know the court date had been moved up, or they were given the wrong court date by ICE officials. So they ended up missing their hearing and then were ruled deportable sort of in absentia. So there's a little bit of controversy surrounding that. But right now, the ICE director is not really commenting on that part and saying, well, we're enforcing the law and those family units are going to be prioritized for removal.
And are these families, for the most part, that had come in and attempted to claim asylum status?
Yeah, that's another really important part of the conversation. Most of these migrants that are coming from the Central American countries, the sort of Northern Triangle countries, are here to claim asylum. They do claim that they're fleeing persecution, violence, harm, torture, a lot of extortion and threats made against families by gang members, for example, is widespread in these countries. For President Trump, we know in his own rhetoric that he views many of these claims as fraudulent, and he thinks that they're just trying to game the system. So he doesn't seem to put much stock in the notion of legitimate claims of asylum.
Talking to Elise Cohen from UW-Green Bay about the president's latest comments on deportation and the latest on the situation with migrants coming from Central America up to the U.S. border. On a practical level, people have raised concerns about the ability of the United States to at least quickly deport millions of people in the course of weeks or months.
Yeah, so the logistical hurdles are really interesting to consider here. Some of those ICE officials that have spoken out, or, you know, previous ICE officials that used to work for the agency that have a little more flexibility to speak out, have said it's just not possible in practical terms. A lot of that is in terms of staffing. It seems like we are getting reports now that ICE is trying to get some agents, sort of borrow some agents from the Department of Homeland Security. Those are people that are probably typically not doing anything related to deportation, but maybe working on human trafficking organizations or something like that, asking to use them as part of this effort to have an increase in deportations in the coming weeks. There's also a detention aspect to this where we are already at quote-unquote capacity in terms of congressionally allocated funds for detention facilities, actually over capacity. There's something like over 50,000 detainees in these migrant detention facilities, and the limit is like 40,000 or so. So you have those sort of staffing constraints, space constraints. Another thing to keep in mind is the legal constraints, right? It's the sort of due process that may be denied if these deportations are expedited, particularly if they try and go beyond those that already have final removal orders. We could see that just create more backlog in the immigration court system than there already is, with attorneys saying, well, that's not fair, that's violating some of the rights, so we're going to need to make a motion to reopen those deportation cases.
Where do we stand now in the United States when it comes to the rate at which we're deporting people compared, for example, to the earlier years of the Obama administration, where people, immigration supporters, criticized him as the deporter in chief?
All right. That's a really great thing to remember. I think it's easy to forget with so much news happening every week, it seems. But it was President Obama who was called the deporter in chief. That was in part because he set a record for, I think it was fiscal year 2012, that he deported over 400,000 unauthorized migrants that year. And he also had some other controversial programs that contributed to that, like the Secure Communities program. What we see with the numbers just on an annual basis, because that's usually how they are offered, how they're provided, is, you know, maybe like 100 or 150,000 less than that has been the annual average in the first couple years of the Trump administration. One thing to keep in mind when you really start digging into the numbers, because I was looking at this earlier today, is filings for removal orders have really increased. So even though those physical deportations that we have the data on are still below that peak under Obama, we do see under the Trump administration a record high for the number of removal orders, kind of getting the deportation proceedings officially started in the immigration courts. So those have gone way up, you know, maybe by about 50,000 a year, more than we saw under the Obama administration.
And how do the numbers of people coming to the United States border from Mexico and of course, Central America compare now to that peak under the earlier years of the Obama administration, late years of the Bush administration?
Well, yeah, that's some more great context with all these numbers. It's sort of interesting because we had seen the first year of the Trump presidency that the numbers were lower. But then what's happened in recent months is particularly families that are fleeing persecution, that are seeking asylum, are reaching new levels. So I think I saw the statistic that last month we had over 140,000 that were taken into custody along the southern border. And that is placed as the highest monthly total in about 13 years. So there really is something going on there. But we have to also be careful because there's sort of this constant language of like surging numbers and a crisis. And we see that year after year, the same kind of language of surging, flowing crisis levels of numbers. But you're right. There is something happening in the last few months, particularly with families. And that's a change from what we saw before.
Elise Cohen is with us from UW Green Bay talking about President Trump's recent statements about upcoming large-scale deportations.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of this move by the administration? Are you excited to hear this from the president as he launches his campaign for reelection? Or does this cause concern and fear in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at possible large-scale deportations starting next week. The president is talking about millions of people potentially being deported. Enforcement officials are looking at numbers more in the thousands. UW Green Bay's Elise Cohen stays with us.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your take on the rhetoric over immigration? How is it affecting your community? Is it on your mind as we look forward towards future policy moves and even future elections? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Elise, before we go to our callers, I've seen something a bit paradoxical. The number is increasing. Some people suggest because of a fear that the borders will be shut down. And I've seen reports, at least, that people who help smuggle people across Mexico and up to the border are saying, hey, go now before tougher constraints come in. And that might be part of why we're seeing bigger numbers this last couple of months. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, I've also seen those reports that particularly those that are maybe even a bit predatory, trying to make money off of those journeys, are telling them, you know, this is going to be your last chance because the window is closing. What you see is the rhetoric always shifts when the numbers are shifting. So sometimes when they go down, the administration officials may say, well, that's because what we're doing is working and we're deterring people from coming. And then when you see the numbers go up, you see this language of, oh, you see, it is a crisis and that's why we have to take unprecedented steps. So it's always a little bit tricky when we're in the middle of it to pinpoint exactly what's going on in terms of driving those numbers. But we know the violence is the constant in terms of why the people would be fleeing in such large numbers from those Central American countries.
Let's bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I believe strongly in legal immigration, but not illegal immigration. And I believe that our borders should be strong, but we need to have our laws reflect the fact that it is the United States drug use that is fueling so much instability in the southern in these countries and is leading to the illegal immigration. We have to recognize that our drug use is really the primary cause for this violence, and we need to stop that now.
Charlie, thanks for the call. So American demand for drugs destabilizing countries that either are the source of the drugs or part of the pipeline for the flow of drugs, Elise, he says.
Yeah, that's a really good point that Charlie, the caller, is making there in terms of what sort of pull factors would be, you know, bringing some of the gang activity and the violence into those border communities. And he's absolutely right that, you know, most of this in terms of supply and demand, it is a U.S.-based demand for those drugs. So where we do see that intensified drug-related criminal activity, a lot of that is surrounding our own demand for those drugs to kind of come in and fuel that violence, particularly even in Central America, where we sort of pushed south what we had seen previously in Mexico. A lot of that is still being fueled by that trafficking into the U.S. for meeting our own demand.
Charlie, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Elizabeth in Duluth. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if the policies that were carried out in Honduras and Nicaragua by Negroponte under a number of presidents had any effect on this mass exodus to the United States.
Elizabeth, thanks. American foreign policy and how it affected the countries that are the source of so much of this migration, Elise.
Yeah, another really great point. Elizabeth is absolutely right. There's a lot of wonderful history that people can read, some great books written on our U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War, and many of the current conditions of violence and particularly corruption that we see in those Central American, quote-unquote, Northern Triangle countries are a result of decades of U.S. foreign policy where we were either propping up certain dictators in terms of fighting against communism, but then really brutally undoing the legitimacy of the institutions and the legal system in those countries. So there's a legacy effect that's still there today. Perhaps we were even directly arming and fueling some of those groups that were fighting on our behalf. And so we still see large-scale circulation of weapons and violence as a result of those foreign policies. So, yeah, it's a great point to think about, you know, how might there be obligations that stem from our own sort of culpable foreign policies in the region.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. Elise, I want to spend our last minute and a half or so on American politics and immigration. We saw candidate Donald Trump originally make his big announcement focusing on immigration, talking about Mexicans in particular. Now, the same week he has his official campaign rally kickoff, he talks about deporting millions. Can you talk about how this fits into the 2020 elections?
Yeah, that's a really great way to end. Absolutely, we can see this in the framework of partisan competition and his 2020 election campaign messaging. If we look to see what he was saying as he kicked off his campaign, he used the language of, "I will be keeping my promises to the American people." And immediately following his election in 2016, he did promise to deport, quote, millions of what he then called criminal aliens. And he said he promised he would deport maybe even up to 3 million. And so if we want to look at that language of fulfilling promises, we can trace that right back to some of the things he said he would do. He also praised mass deportation way back in November 2015 in one of those Republican presidential primary debates under Eisenhower, sort of the largest deportation we saw, called the very derogatory terminology of Operation Wetback. But Trump, when he was a candidate, praised that for deporting over a million people. So we can kind of see this playing very nicely into shoring up support among his base and painting the Democrats as really being against border security.
Elise, we'll check in with you again before long, I'm sure. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Elise Cohen is an immigration expert and associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. She joined us for a look at the president's statement that there would be mass deportations starting next week. Let us know what you think. If this is something that affects you or your community, you can email us ideas@WPR.org. The Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection issued more than 1,300 licenses to grow industrial hemp this year, a 22% increase from last year. But some producers who grew the new crop back in 2018 say they no longer think it's a simple solution to farmers' financial woes. WPR's Hope Kerwin has more.
Last spring, LaVon Felton was all in when it came to industrial hemp. Felton owns car dealerships in Viroqua, and he has an organic farm outside of town. In 2018, he had a contract to grow 48 acres of hemp grain for Legacy Hemp, a company out of North Dakota. On a sunny day in May, he took his best guess on how to plant the newly approved crop.
So I'm going to start at a wheat setting at 40 pounds an acre, and then I'll adjust as needed. So we're just going to fill up the grain drill.
Even though hemp grain had never been grown in Wisconsin, Felton believed it could help farmers struggling with low prices for traditional commodities like milk and corn. Looking back now, he says the lack of information wasn't his biggest obstacle. It was simply the persistent rains that impacted fields across the state.
You know, it just couldn't get dried out. It just rained a lot. So when we did get it harvested, we came up with a good product, but it tested too high for mold spores in the grain.
Felton didn't sell a single pound of the hemp grain he harvested in 2018, and neither did the roughly 20 other farmers who contracted with Legacy Hemp. Between the seed, fertilizer, required testing, and other expenses, Felton estimates the endeavor cost him at least $20,000. And he wants farmers planting hemp this year to know they're taking a risk.
At least if we have a corn crop that doesn't go well, or beans, we're going to get something. You know, we're going to be able to recoup some of our costs. You know, basically with this, if you lose it, you lose it all.
Corn and soybeans with small amounts of mold can still be sold for livestock feed. But the only market for hemp grain is for human consumption. So Felton says he doesn't think growing hemp grain will ever be profitable in Wisconsin because of the climate. The state doesn't have the same arid summers as plain states like North Dakota, where hemp grain has been grown since 2016. And Legacy Hemp agronomist Brian Parr says his company is starting to agree, especially if Wisconsin continues to see frequent heavy rain events at the end of summer.
If it's not going to be conducive in Wisconsin because of our, our changing climate, then it may not be the best crop to be growing in Wisconsin for grain.
Parr says the state's farmers have a much better shot in the hemp fiber market and the rapidly expanding wellness industry around cannabidiol oil, or CBD. But growing hemp for CBD products has had its own problems. Just ask Bob Povelmacher, who farms part-time near Lone Rock. Povelmacher planted 3 acres of hemp for CBD in 2018 and harvested around 1,000 pounds of hemp buds with a fairly high percentage of CBD. At the current market rate, Povelmacher should get around $450 per pound for the buds. But he can't find enough buyers.
I've got a bunch of different shops that are buying it, but they're only a pound or 2 pounds at a time. So it's pretty slow. I mean, it's steady, but it's slow.
Povelmacher says the larger CBD manufacturers he's contacted already have more than enough hemp. So he's having to work harder to market his product. He's even invested in lab equipment so he can make a hemp extract on his farm, a less processed version of CBD oil. And he is optimistic the market is catching up. This year, DATCAP issued 600 processor licenses, 100 more than last year. Povelmacher says adding industrial hemp to his farm has not been easy, but he says the risks around the new crop are no different than the gamble every farmer takes when planting a field.
This is just another facet of the business. You know, it's another crop, and hopefully this one works and the other ones will come around and one of those will work some other year.
He's taking another chance on industrial hemp this year and helping a group of local farmers grow about 10 acres of hemp for CBD. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule on a handful of high-profile cases over the next few weeks, from gerrymandering and whether laws apply to district lines drawn on partisan grounds, and workplace discrimination against members of the LGBT community. We'll find out what's at stake on those and other key cases.
Fewer kids are riding bikes these days, and health advocates say that's not good news. Our guest gives us the story behind those numbers.
And it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we'll celebrate celery. Now, that's not something that everybody likes, but if you think you don't like it, we've got some twists and surprises for you. Celery in bread. Lori Skelton's going to be on. She made some celery bread. Pretty good. Celery in desserts. Jury's out. And celery in drinks, which I have not tried, but I'm hearing great things from all the people,
celery.
For the youth.
When she suggested celery, I was all in for celery.
That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.